Hello, and welcome. I'm Meron Khalili. We are DiEM25, a radical political movement for Europe. And this is another live stream with subversive ideas you won't hear anywhere else. And tonight, we're asking a simple question. Who controls your image? Who controls your story? Something odd is happening in public life on the left. Many of you will know that our own Yanis Varoufakis has recently been dealing with two very different things at the same time. On the one hand, deep fake videos of him have been circulating online, not as political attacks, but made to go viral, and they've been watched millions of times. On the other, he's faced police harassment over comments made decades ago. These aren't the same issue, but they sit next to each other, and together they raise harder questions about credibility, imitation, memory, and power. Who gets to define who you are? Who gets to edit the past? And who is immune from scrutiny? This isn't just about well-known figures either. Anyone who speaks publicly now, organizers, activists, writers, campaigners, is exposed to versions of this, maybe not at the same scale, but with real consequences. Now, these are questions that the award-winning author and journalist Naomi Klein has been grappling with for years. In her recent book, Doppelganger, she looks at how identities are copied, distorted, and reused, and what that does to truth, politics, and public life. So tonight, we're going to bring together these two perspectives. Naomi has been analyzing these dynamics, and Yanis has been living them. We'll talk about what happens when you lose control of your image, what it means when institutions can reach back into your past while remaining largely untouchable themselves. And we'll ask how movements can speak clearly and ask and act effectively without adding to the noise. So we've got Naomi Klein, Yanis Varoufakis, and you out there. This is live on YouTube. So if you've got thoughts, comments, rants, put them in the YouTube chat and keep them on topic, please. And we'll put them to our panel. Yanis, let's start with you. What was it like to see versions of yourself running around circulating that you couldn't recognize or control?
Exceedingly weird. Thank you, Maren. Naomi, it's a great pleasure and an honor to be with you again on a panel here at DiEM25. Maren, let me answer your question by means of a fascinating little story. Should I call it stories? Something that happened to me 2 nights ago. I received a very pleasant message from some producer working for the BBC, BBC Television. What he said was, Yanis, we watched that talk you gave recently on YouTube regarding Maduro and Greenland and this and that, and we would love to talk to you about this on our program. So I clicked on the link that he included in that WhatsApp message, and to my horror, it wasn't me. It was a deep fake AI version of me. Now, it's one thing to have really unsophisticated, you know, doppelgangers. It's quite another to have rather sophisticated ones, especially when somebody like that particular BBC producer considers it to be so sophisticated that he wanted to have me on his program. I had to write to him and say, mate, it wasn't me. It was a deep fake AI of mine. Okay, so it is amazing how quickly these doppelgangers are improving, to the extent that, you know, they can confuse venerable editors and producers. I have to tell you, Naomi, that there was another one which I was convinced that I was going senile, because another video of mine. Mm-hmm. And because I was convinced it was me, because it was saying things I would have said.
Yeah.
Except the reason why I realized it wasn't me was because I was wearing a blue shirt against this background here. This is my Athens office. And that blue shirt had never left my home on the island. And that's how I realized it wasn't me. And then I watched a little bit more, and suddenly, you know, everything that was being said, which is stuff I could have said, right, suddenly was punctuated by something I would never say, and that, you know, my enemies could easily use to defame me.
Yeah.
So, you know, coming face to face with these doppelgangers immediately, my mind and Meron's mind. I think it was Meron first before me. We thought of your book. You know, the trip inside the mirror of our media world, And we thought, this is there can be no better excuse to invite Naomi Klein to talk to us about this.
Naomi. Well, I'm always happy. I'm always happy for an excuse. And I am so happy to talk with you about it, Yanis, because when I was made this strange decision to write about my experience of having a doppelganger of somebody who a lot of people, many, many people at scale thought was me, who and this was not a digital deep fake, this was another person. But I had this feeling that I was getting a glimpse of the future. Like I had this feeling that we were all going to be battling our digital doppelgangers soon enough, because as I was experiencing this, that was when we started to really see, deep fakes get better and better, and ChatGPT came out. And so, I used my own doppelganger experience really as a kind of a lens to go through the mirror and imagine where this was all going. And in some ways, this is the logical conclusion of, the attention economy and the way we have all, in many ways, lost control over ourselves already. Like you've experienced something very extreme with all of these hundreds of thousands or millions of views of people watching you, and it's not you. And it's, I think for you, it's happening both out of political motivation in some cases where there you obviously have enemies and there are people who would like to discredit you. But then you also are, I'm sorry to say it, but a successful brand and monetizable. And so, when you see all of this, there's somebody out there going, there's Yanis Varoufakis. He has lost. He's leaving money on the table. He could be out there monetizing nonstop. I had this wild experience, Yanis, where not long after Doppelganger came out, I got a couple of letters and then somebody pitched me on it. I met them on a plane and they were like, you should really have a doppelganger, basically saying you could be making all this money. There could be a virtual you that would represent you at all these conferences you wouldn't have to go to. I was like, have you read the book? Like, this is really not the way I think we should be living our lives, right? But there is this whole industry where people are going to public figures and saying, listen, there could be a whole other you that is out there representing you that is making these YouTube videos. But just to finish the thought around why this is the logical conclusion, we already lost control over ourselves, as you know, and as you wrote in Technofeudalism, they already took all of our data. They already trained their AIs on our books. They already trained them on everything we've ever said. So that data was the digital doppelganger waiting to happen. And then it's fed through AI and lo and behold, there you are on YouTube. So, this has been a long time in coming. And as we've sort of rationalized every step along the way, well, maybe I don't need that data after all. Maybe it's okay that they trained on our books, on our words. Eventually they come to take our, as our face, our voice, our skin, and then you're fighting. I mean, I heard you talk about it. I'd love to hear you talk more about it. The experience of interfacing with these black box companies, right? Because you can't call Google and be like, hey, take this down, because it's built to not have a human there. So what happens when you try to get yourself back? Oh, you're muted. You're muted.
Yanis, I think you're still muted.
Sorry about that.
There you are. It's the microphone button.
Yeah, it's the microphone.
Okay, so going live. Yeah. Go ahead.
What I was saying while I was muted is that, what happens now is you hit a brick wall. Because, my experience was that I wrote to Google because they are the owners of YouTube, and most of those fakes, not all of them, but most of them were on YouTube. And I got no response for a while. Then when they did respond, they asked me to fill more forms in, and then more forms in, and then more forms in, and then more. You know that these people, if they want to block a video, they can do it in fractions of a second. So it's clearly the business model to utilize your audiovisual image, because tragically, I have to tell you that over the last 2 months, my AI fakes had a lot more views than I did. And that is their business model. This is how they amass people's data in order to target advertisements and in order to create a traffic that glues people's eyeballs on the screen. So to them, these AI deepfakes were more lucrative than the real me. And eventually, it took 7-8 days before they brought down the original deepfakes. And within between 24 and 25 seconds, the same, because my team monitored that, exactly the same videos and more videos appeared in another YouTube channel. So it's like, you know, a hydra. You cut off one head, 10 new heads grow back in fractions of a second. So this is, and we know that this is not the result of some technical glitch within the beast that is Google or TikTok or Instagram. This is their business model. And in the end, in the same way that, you know, you remember, especially after 2008, it wasn't the communists that took people's homes, but it was Wall Street. And it was the, you know, the bankers who requisitioned and repossessed the few belongings of the working class and the petty bourgeoisie that saw its dreams of becoming members of the property class go up in smoke after the Lehman Brothers collapse in 2008. Now, we don't even own, forget our data, we don't even own our audiovisual image.
You know, forgive me for saying this, Yiannis, but I'm thinking your experience reminds me of Cory Doctorow's phrase, inshittification, because really what you're describing is being inshittified, right? Like that there is this version of you that is willing to do all of these kind of grotesque gimmicks in order to get the views, right? I mean, I've seen the thumbnails, right? With your head in your hands and, you know, like it is, you could be getting more views if you wanted it, if you devoted yourself to only that, right? If your goal in life was to maximize your engagement, right? And so this is why, you know, I said earlier that this is the logical conclusion of all of us going on to their platforms, right? And making these little deals with ourselves that, okay, well, maybe it'll be good because people, okay, I don't love that I'm giving all this content to this social media company, but, you know, it'll bring them over to the books eventually and I'll kind of have some control over it. We make these deals. But really, I think this goes back further. You know, my first book, wrote it in the 90s, you know, was called No Logo. And what that book was about the rise of personal branding in part, right? Like the idea of the lifestyle brand, but also this idea, and this is where the book ended, was this then novel idea in the 90s that, yes, okay, we were all losing our jobs and we were told that we were going to have to imagine a future with a series of contracts rather than a job, which was then a new idea and now is, you know, what everybody expects. But that was okay because we were all going to be personal brands, right? And at the time, it was a absurd concept, the idea that everyone could be a personal brand, right? Because everybody didn't have an advertising agency. You know, this at the end of the 90s, only Oprah could be a brand and Michael Jordan, not, you know, just a regular person. But then along comes the iPhone and social media, and we all have access to this free advertising agency. But, you know, I think about who is making the deep fakes of you, right? And there's clearly people who are not in it for malicious reasons. They're in it, they're just hustling. You know, they're just hustling. And they are people who have grown up in this, who know that they can never get a job. And they have taken courses about how to not get trampled by capitalism. And and they have concluded that, you know, there's money to be made by monetizing your brand because you're not doing it well enough. And so I do think we have to step back and you know, it is about the platform economy, but it's really just about where capitalism has taken us. How do you feel about the people who are doing it?
Well, I've watched quite a few of those, as you can imagine, and I can see that there are different motivations by different groups of these fakers. Some of them are just out there to make money, clearly. They're there for the views, for the, you know, for cranking up the monetization machine of YouTube, of Instagram, and so on. Then a small percentage are quite genuine, and they do say in their channels that this is a deep fake. This is not Yannis Varoufakis, but what we've done is we've taken some of his ideas and we try to animate them by giving it using his face. We don't have his permission, but we try to stay loyal to him. And usually, those ones they do say things I would have said, and then there's the third category. Mm-hmm. The third is the most malicious one. Right. The ones who want to do serious damage to me. So they take things I would have said on Ukraine, on Gaza, on Palestine. And then, after 20 sentences that are consistent with my views and what I would have said, suddenly they insert a sentence which is clearly pro-Putin or clearly anti-Semitic in order to show me up as a, Putin handmaiden or an anti-Semite. And that, for me, personally speaking, you can imagine that, right? Yeah. This is the most lethal use of it. But you mentioned Cory Doctorow, who, by the way, is a friend of this program. Mm-hmm. He's been here on DMT TV. And his entitification hypothesis, which is fascinating, because it goes far beyond the idea of surveillance capitalism. Because you see, if you look at Zuboff's book and this idea that monopoly capital is utilizing the social media in order essentially to do a better job at directing our consumption patterns in the interests of vendors, of multinational corporations. No, it's far worse than that. And I think, mm-hmm. Dr. O is very good at explaining why it's much worse than that. Because this is, of course, they do that. But if you compare it to, let's say, to the advertising companies of the 1960s and 1970s, who were totally aligned in terms of their interests with Coca-Cola, with McDonald's, with Bethlehem Steel, with whatever monopoly capitalist firm that they were working for. Google and Meta are not like that. What they do is they lure both us as serfs entering those cloud fiefs, well, that's what I call their platforms, their digital platforms, as consumers and users, but they also lure companies in, manufacturers, makers of coffee makers, or manufacturers of coffee makers, of electric bicycles, this and that, right? And or publishers, for that matter, magazines, newspapers. They make a lot of money for them, initially, and that's the whole point about entitification. Once you rely on that platform to sell your wares as a small capitalist, a medium-sized capitalist, even a large-scale capitalist, like the New York Times or Washington Post, then what the platforms do is they push your company down in the orderings and in the hierarchy, in visibility terms, and then effectively blackmail you. If you want to push you up again, then you have to give us a larger share of your revenues. So the whole point about incentivization is that these cloud fiefdoms, these digital platforms, lure you in, and once you depend on it, I mean, another example is Uber. Right, Uber has a monopsony discrimination pattern whereby what they do is they offer much higher rates per mile, per kilometer, to drivers that are reluctant to use the Uber app. And once they lure them in, they then offer them loans to get a better car in order to get an even higher mile per mile rate. And once they indebt them, once these drivers are indebted and completely fused with the platform, then suddenly there is a precipitous fall in their wage rates. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's the process of incentivization.
Yeah. And I mean, I you're going to jump in, but I'll come back.
Well, I just wanted to jump in quickly with a couple of questions and comments from the chat, and then I'll hand it to you, Naomi. Thank you for giving way. It's first one from Scary Socks. AI being built on theft makes it totally immoral. Sile McNutt adds, I suggest that you have to prove that any video is genuinely you, like a watermark on paper notes. I don't know how exactly. And there are lots of suggestions that go in this direction, sort of technological solutions for this. Xvale talks about a digital signature. We lock the content at the time of creation. Terry asks, how can we combat these imposters without intimate knowledge of those they're copying? So as I hand it back to you, Naomi, if you can take account of some of those questions and also you, Yanis, after. And if I can ask you the danger of all this deepfakery and doppelganging, is that just misrepresentation or is there a hit to credibility in the long term when these things happen?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot going on. I mean, first of all, on the question of whether or not we could ban deepfakes or do something about this, of course, there's so many things that could be done and are not being done because these companies are as powerful as they are and because they're running governments. I mean, you think about something like what Grok did what Elon Musk did through Grok in allowing his AI to digitally undress women, girls, basically make child porn, but really humiliate women at scale, right? I mean, it was used as a political tool, really. What Yanis is describing about, you know, your political enemies going after you and putting words in your mouth that you would never say. Well, to women, they just take women's clothes off and put whipped cream all over their face, right? And this is what's being allowed to happen on these platforms. It would be so easy to do, to just, you know, ban it and, you know, ban the companies altogether if they don't follow the rules. But what we are living in is a revolt against the most sensible basic regulations that would have prevented this because these companies are racing one another. They're using China as the excuse, right? In order to be the last company in the world standing. I mean, if you listen to them, this is what they say. Sam Altman gets very carried away and says, eventually we will literally be serfs. He says we can all get shares in OpenAI, the last company in the world. So the stakes of it for all these companies, the mania of it, you know, I can't, like the speed with which for Elon Musk built these supercomputers in Memphis, poisoning the entire community. With these, I don't know if you followed this at all, Yanis, but he targeted a poor black area of the United States, and Mr. Green Energy himself powered the largest supercomputer in the world. Now there's three of them to power Grok with these massive turbines, gas burning turbines that are meant to be temporary. Blocks of them. He built his own power station and poisoned the air because he was in a race to beat Sam Altman and a race to beat Google. So they're not going to accept regulation. It's not that we don't know how to do this. I mean, maybe you disagree on us, but I think that it would be possible to regulate. It's that we are in a very successful revolt against regulation where they fired all their content moderators. They don't want this to work for us. They want it to work for them.
I don't disagree with you at all. To have regulation, you need to have a state that has a degree of autonomy from those who are going to be regulated. Otherwise, the regulators get captured. And the horror of the horror that oozes out of what I call cloud capital, these machines that are not producing anything except for the power to modify and manipulate people's behavior. Those machines bequeath upon their owners a remarkable capacity to incapacitate the state, to incapacitate the regulators. So even though you're totally right, absolutely right, Naomi, it would take, about an hour for Google to find a way of killing these deep fake AIs. I mean, look how quickly and efficiently their algorithms can eradicate any violation of the copyright of other corporations. If you and I try to put a little bit of music by our friend Brian Eno or by, Pink Floyd in one of our YouTube videos and we upload it, within seconds, the Google algorithm knows that we have infringed some copyright rule. So they could do something very similar in order to make sure that these deepfake AIs are not there. But they choose not to because they can get away with it. And they, you know, you mentioned Elon Musk. It is clear that the entitification, to use Corey's term again, of Twitter, the manner in which Twitter has become a sewer, effectively a digital sewer. Now, the question is this because Elon Musk lost control of X, or is it because he's a great believer in freedom of speech, of the ones who want to defecate all over our digital social media? Or is it something else? For me, it's, you know, it's a Steve Bannon story. You know, flood the zone. Ask, I'm addressing our audience now, you know, who benefits from a social media which is full of noise?
And Nazis.
Establishment. You know, the people who do not want change. The people who do not want a state that regulates them. The people who do not want the demos to have any stake in the democracy, the so-called democracy. Yeah. The ones who want essentially to take over everything. Everything from industry, from small businesses, from bricks and mortars, groceries, you know, with Instacart, from, you know, they want to take over our news media, and they have, either because they have replaced it or they've simply gobbled it up, like, you know, the Washington Post. That is, and, you know, then he gives directives to his journalists, do not challenge anything that is consistent with the maintenance of my power over the demos. This is a political problem. It's not a technological problem. It's fully a political problem. We could have introduced legislation to impose interoperability so you can get out of Twitter and go into Blue Sky, for instance, and not lose access to your followers. But we're not doing it. By the way, the Chinese have done that. The Chinese government has put enormous constraints on their social media. And they were not constraints on free speech, which is what Elon Musk would say. No, they are constraints on the exorbitant power of the owners of the social media.
I mean, there are also constraints on free speech, but, you know, yeah, I mean, but there's so much that they could do. And I, you know, I find myself thinking, especially, you know, the context of how long I've known you and the context in which we met in the, you know, aftermath of the financial crisis. There's a crisis coming in all of this. There's going to be a huge market correction when the AI bubble bursts, right? They are so overleveraged, all of these titans who are racing one another to be the last company standing. They're building duplicative data centers all over the world in order to have more and more and more of what they call compute, right? And they all know that there is only room for just one titan left, right? And so I'm not somebody who believes the whole thing is going down, but I do think there's going to be a major correction. And there are going to be bailouts of some kind. And if we did have any kind of sovereignty and we were able to regulate these companies, that would be the moment, right? That would be the moment when they have their hands out to say, didn't you steal all of human knowledge to build your companies? Like, who actually owns these? You know, maybe that could be the moment where we would assert our right to a digital commons. But of course, who's the we? You know, who would do that in that moment? I don't know if you've thought about what happens when this bubble bursts, but, and how we might maybe have a little bit more control, what we could do. Because I think people are feeling so powerless in the face of this, right? I mean, I think we can diagnose it, but what do we do?
Well, last time a bubble, an enormous bubble burst in 2008, we saw what happened. What followed was socialism for the financiers who had caused this bubble and austerity for everyone else. And the result of that was discontent, which people like Trump and the neo-fascists around the world harvested the discontent that it created, and it created the Nationalist International, the neo-fascist cabal that is taking over all over, including Latin America. But Naomi, because you mentioned the bubble of the AI that bursts, and, you know, allow me to offer my perspective on that. Mm-hmm. Because, you see, there are two uses of AI from the perspective of Google, Meta, and all these people. there is a standard capitalist implementation. So OpenAI, it's a standard capitalist firm, because what it does is it sells you subscriptions to its ChatGPT in the same way that, you know, insurance companies sell insurance contracts and so on and so forth. Now, that is a bubble that will burst. There's no doubt about that. Because if you look at the, if you compare and contrast the linear increase in OpenAI's revenues from selling this capitalist service to the exponential increase in the costs of improving upon the quality of their large language models, you know, it's clear that this divergence is just the makings of a bubble that will burst.
Their sales don't even cover their interest on their capital expense.
No way. So that will burst. But this is not the interesting use of AI, because the real smart cookies in Silicon Valley, they're not producing a service to be sold in any capitalist market, unlike OpenAI. OpenAI is going to go hit a wall if it continues with this model. The Googles of the world and the Metas of the world and the Microsofts and the Oracles and the Palantirs of the world, what they do is they take AI and they incorporate it in their behavior modification machinery. So, you know, Alexa, which is the device that Amazon sells you in order to be able to order it around to, you know, buy you milk, and you ask it to propose books to buy, and you seek advice from it regarding, you know, what commodities to purchase and so on. Well, already the manner in which it interfaces with you because of AI has improved dramatically. Very soon, I just came back from the Web Summit in Qatar, and I interrogated some of these new AI-driven machines, and they speak to you like a friend. And, you know, essentially, they are being developed in such a way as to become integrated with your social milieu. Yeah. Very soon, they will know everything about you. And not only know everything about you, already they know mostly everything about you, but they will communicate with you in a way that appeals to your psyche. They will know every bad moment you had, every moment of celebration you had. They will be able to, you know, be your shrink, your lover, your child, your parent, your grandparent. And once they have this kind of interface with you, they will be able to sell you anything. And getting rid of it, you know, getting rid of Amazon's AI device to go with Microsoft's, it will be like a heart-wrenching divorce. So that means the capacity of Jeff Bezos through Alexa to hold you absolutely, you know, bounded and shackled to his cloud fief, to his platform, is going to be just unsaleable. Mm-hmm. And at that point, you know, his capacity to charge rents to anyone who sells you anything, 40% of everything you pay will go to Jeff Bezos. Now, that model is not going to be a bubble that bursts. What that model does is it creates what I call techno-feudalism. Effectively, you are a serf to the Lord. The producer, even the capitalist firm that produces the bicycle or the coffee maker, is going to be like a vassal artisan that needs to sustain the wealth creation dynamic of Jeff Bezos at the behest of Jeff Bezos. And macroeconomically, what that means is that there's going to be even worse stagnation than we have, because if you take 40% out of GDP and you put it in the pockets of Jeff Bezos, it's not just unfair, it's not just unjust, it's not just, you know, mind-numbing inequality. What also is happening is aggregate demand is shrinking. which means that the quality of jobs is going to be going down the toilet, which means that central banks will have to inflate the economy so they will create more inflation against the working class. Essentially, going back to incentivization, this is the incentivization of the whole system, but also in a way that because our dialogues, our conversations are poisoned by the same algorithms, the space, the room for the kind of conversation between us, which is essential in order to create political movements to respond to the crisis that these machines are precipitating, you know, that space, that window is shrinking.
And even thinking about the kind of political derangements that really accelerated during the pandemic, in that period when we all kind of moved our lives online, that wasn't a coincidence, right? I mean, we're not built for this level of mediation. We need those in-person experiences. Sorry. There's another side to it, which Maren was pointing towards earlier. Now, I think about the way these companies also are completely have become a tool of Trump's foreign policy. Mm-hmm. That's not even the right, they're not a tool. They're running Trump's foreign policy. It's a complete merger. And I think about what happened to our friend Francesca Albanese the day after she published her excellent report on the economy of genocide, Israel's economy of genocide, and named the names of many of the tech companies that we've been discussing and talked about their legal complicity. And the next day, or maybe it was the same day that the report came out, Marco Rubio imposed U.S. sanctions. And that means you lose your access to all of these tech companies that we've become so dependent on, right? I mean, you're talking about a level of the therapist. I mean, what you're describing about that level of love, it already exists. I mean, people go into states of grief when they change the ChatGPT model and they lose the love of their life, right? Or who they thought was the love of their life. But now we're seeing the way these tech companies integrated with U.S. foreign policy, right, are being used against ICC judges, are being used against people who, you know, worked as moderators. So you lose your Google account, you lose your Microsoft account, you lose, you know, your ability to bank. I'm wondering about there's this strange, on the one hand, you're told that you have to accept that you're losing control over how you're represented online. But on the other hand, on the other side, you're also told that your entire life can be destroyed over, you know, a Facebook like, right? I mean, we know people who've been thrown in jail for retweeting something, right? So how do we, like this seems like an untenable level of tension of, on the one hand, lose all control. On the other hand, you're responsible for something that you retweeted 10 years ago, and that could get you deported or that can get you arrested. I mean, I feel like my brain's going to explode thinking about this.
Can I just jump in with a couple of comments and questions, and then I'll hand it to Yanis? R. Cannoli says the regulators and the regulated are to a large degree one and the same. Sonny Salazar says they, meaning tech titans, they're not demonic, they're perfectly human cynics. Calling Larry says that we've been training AI this whole time with captures, and if we use it, we train it. Good point. Two more cynical comments. Kurt Boss says they kill kids and no one gives a fuck, but your identity, oh cruel world. And Ronnie's mobile phone says, easy solution. Stop being a celebrity and be an actual revolutionary. Lastly, I Love Music says the algorithms can get rid of any Gaza content pretty quick and any criticism of Israel. So if they wanted to, they could keep the platforms clean of garbage. Yes.
100%. Yeah. Yeah. In an instant. Yeah. So, I mean, that's a really good point. And I've heard you talk about this, Yanis, around like, why you're not going to spend your life trying to get these deep fakes taken down. And, you know, this is why I decided to just get interested in doppelgangers and really interrogate this question of, like, you know, how personal branding got us here, right? And I do think there's a lot of truth to that this is telling us something. We should get the fuck off these algorithms. We should get off these platforms. The whole idea of monetizing the self is a dead end. We have to figure out another way to live. On the other hand, these companies are so powerful that I don't think that we can just step back and say, you know, okay, we're just all going to touch grass and leave it to them, because they'll, you know, they are destroying the world and we have to live in the world, right? Even just from a climate perspective, we can't just leave it to them, right? On top of everything else, this is burning so much carbon as it, so yeah.
No, we have a responsibility to take it over, to socialize, you know, those of us who grew up in a socialist tradition, grew up with the dream of socializing the means of production, distribution, and exchange. Well, now we have to add to that the means of communication. There's no sense in abandoning those means of the communication to big tech. What we need to do is we need to use them smartly in a kind of guerrilla warfare, you know, moving from one platform to another, making sure that, you know, we use all this in order to do that which you say in your book, Doppelganger, which is, if I'm, correct me if I'm wrong, in order to organize in three dimensions, in order to organize at the level of the neighborhood, of the workplace, of the community. But we need, you know, how are we talking to one another now?
Yeah, we deserve an information commons. Yeah. And this is why I think it does matter that they have stolen from us at the scale that they have. That's and right. I think as more and more people experience what you have experienced, where you have your very face and voice stolen, right? We should be enraged by this. My friend and co-author Astra Taylor calls it theft tech. These are not legitimate business models. They are built on theft. They are built on, you know, yes, they collaborate with the Israeli government. They also use the same model of facts on the ground just move so fast. And this is where I think Shoshana Zuboff is right, you know, and where she describes Google's whole model, right, of, you know, something like Street View, of just going out there, breaking the law, moving faster than regulators. And of course, regulators, you know, feign that the inability to regulate when they can, but then say, it's, you know, it's too late. We've already enclosed, you know, your street. We've already enclosed your house under our business model, right? We've already enclosed, you know, everything that's ever been written and every piece of art that's ever been produced. It's now ours. This whole model is illegitimate, right? And I think, you know, if when the day comes when we get to take back our information commons, this is the center of our argument. So, yeah.
Going back to Francesca Albanese, whom you mentioned, our common friend, the great warrior for international law, not just in Palestine, but across the world. It wasn't just that she lost her access to social media. She lost her access to her bank account. She owns one asset, that's an apartment in New York, and she just can't sell it because the United States authorities effectively blocked it. In the same way they're blocking, you know, Vladimir Putin's assets, supposedly, they're blocking the assets of Francesca Albanese. You know, we met in Genova some time ago, and she couldn't book a hotel room. Not only because she had no access to credit cards, but because no booking agency would take a booking from Francesca Albanese. So so I think Francesca is a good example of how these three, nodes of the new form of feudalism that we're facing are coming together. One is social media, the other is finance, they're in cahoots, and the third, of course, is the military-industrial complex, which is now taking over by big tech.
Of course.
And I'll be very specific about this now, because I was having a conversation with somebody that was working for Palantir up until very recently, and in that conversation, I had a number of strokes, or quasi-strokes, because he was telling me how great Gaza was for them. Mm-hmm. And I asked him to elaborate. And he said, oh, of course, what was happening to the Palestinians is terrible. But for us, it was fantastic. And I said, please go ahead, explain this to me. And he said, well, you know, he pointed at my phone, which was sitting there on the table, the coffee table. Idle. And he said, your phone now is useless to me because it's not moving. If it's not moving, it's not producing data. But if you're moving around with it, and I can correlate the movements of your eye, of your phone, with everything else that you're doing in your life, what you're talking about, what you're, you know, discussing on the phone, what you, and so on, I create a lot of statistical correlation that can help me train my algorithms. So when you bomb a densely populated area, you create a lot of movement. People die, but others survive, and they run around, and they pick up the phone, they try to find, to call their friends, to find out about their loved ones. And that is how they trained the algorithms, which now they are selling to the British National Health Service, state-owned public hospitals. There was a recent maybe up to £1 billion worth of a contract that sold these technologies to hospitals in Birmingham, in Manchester, and so on, for organizing the movements of the nursing staff and the doctors if there is, let's say, a pile up on the motorway and many ambulances come in at the same time and there's panic in the hospital. So they have algorithms that help them organize the hospital, and these have been trained in Gaza. So put this together, the way in which privatization of services in public hospitals are interlocked with, you know, the genocide in Gaza. How Francesca Albanese's revelation of this causes the banking system to ban her from using, from having access to her own money. Mm-hmm. And that's how you have this triangle of hyper-looting between finance, the military-industrial complex, and of course, the one node that used to be relatively insignificant, which is now taking over everything, and that is big tech.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's also being used, as you know, I think probably many of the people watching and listening know, it's being used by ICE in the United States and in Minneapolis. So this, the back end of, you know, how do these ICE agents know which house to go to, you know, whether people are there. And now it's also being used on the protesters themselves, right? So you see that maybe not be Palantir tech, but what's being used, it's some of them are companies from Israel where they're just sticking a phone in someone's face and it immediately uses facial recognition software and feeds it in. It's also, all of this is also being used to target people. I mean, can you talk a little bit? I know we just have a little bit more time, but they're digging up things that you said a very long time ago. And, you know, I mean, take it as a compliment, right? I mean, I think that all of this is happening to you for the same reason, right? But for whatever reason, they want to take you out. So what happened?
Well, that wasn't so much social media. Well, it was in a sense, because, you know, what happened was...
I guess I mean AI can just hoover it all up. Everything we've ever said, every podcast we've ever done, right? And find the one thing that might be criminalizable.
Indeed. But it wasn't exactly that. What happened was I was invited by a young couple, 21-year-old kids, a boy and a girl, who are in the rave scene. They are into, you know, the music world that excites young people. Why does it excite them? This is what they were telling me, because it allows them to escape their screens. Mm-hmm. It allows them to escape their social media world. So for them, being in one room, large room, you know, dancing to the same music without phones, without earphones, feeling proximity, social proximity, and, you know, the smell of other bodies and so on, with music and so on and so forth. So these were effectively ravers. And I was in a theater that I had booked, and they were interviewing me. We talked about the future of work. We talked about education, about music, about film, about all that. In the midst of all that, because of course they are ravers, right? I mean, they know a lot more than I do, and probably more than you do, about substances, about, you know, drugs, about MDMA, about hallucinogenics in general. One of them, the girl, asked me, "Mr. Varoufakis, have you ever used?" Now, I could have been Bill Clinton at the time and said, you know, I didn't inhale. But I said, yeah, of course, I was at university, I smoked pot. I still like pot. Nobody gives me any because my you know, friends and so on, they say you should stay away from it. And once I said I had some ecstasy. I remember it was 37 years ago in Sydney at a rave party. And it was great because, you know, I could dance for 16 hours and that I didn't feel gravity anymore. But then I paid for it because I had a migraine for a whole week and I never touched it again. And, you know, the point I was trying to make was that, you know, the Satan is addiction. That's where you lose control, you lose your autonomy, you lose your freedom. That was my way of communicating with them. Now, this was a YouTube video, and the ruling right-wing party in Greece, they have, this is quite exciting, they have a propaganda unit, which they call it the Truth Commission. They have a sense of humor, don't they? I mean, they're taking it straight out of 1984. So essentially what they do is they lie. They call it the Truth Commission. And what they do is they take clips of their opponents and they just revert the meaning of what you said. So, but it was very well done. So they take this out. They flood the Greek social media with, you know, Varoufakis, AIDS and abets drug taking. And the Minister of the Police and the Minister of Health, who, by the way, are responsible for doing away with, you know, just huge cuts in all the institutions that we have in place in order to help people overcome addiction. You know, they've done away with that through austerian cuts and so on. On television, that day in a panel, both those ministers demanded of the district attorney that I should be charged for aiding and abetting the drug trade. Yeah, so you see what happened.
Yeah. So they took the clip and they made it sound like you were giving an advertisement.
Moving
for ecstasy. Okay, yeah.
Exactly.
But I mean, I do think that this is related to what we were talking about earlier around deep fakes and the nudification. I mean, these are kind of tools of humiliation that are trying to drive people out of public life or just out of public forums, right? Like the whole point of what people are doing on Twitter with women is just to push women out, you know? So then women don't want to post on Twitter anymore. You certainly don't want to post a photograph of yourself, right? I mean, so what is this doing? I mean, they're trying to make it so you don't put a video out, right? Because you always have to imagine how it's going to be twisted.
Indeed.
Yeah. So this is a very, more than flooding the zone, right? This is driving people out of public life. This is a political strategy. Indeed. Yeah.
Driving out of public life those that may be detrimental to the interests of the big tech companies and
it's not just famous people. This is what I'm saying. It's happening just because people are women, just because they're saying or just because they're on the left. It's happening, and as we know, it's happening to people who post about Israel, who say the word Zionism on TikTok. There's all kinds of ways that we're being purged.
Can I just jump in very quickly, because we've got about 7 minutes, and I'd like to leave audiences with some positive, constructive ideas. So, just to pick up on what you said there, Naomi, like, what do you guys think could be the solutions to this challenge of deep fakes, of identity theft, and so on? Some people on the chat are also calling for that. I mean, we've talked about, for example, nationalizing the platforms, but what's the first step to that? An alternative model could be to use the public platforms for reach, and as you alluded to earlier, Naomi, funnel people to your own platforms where you control, for example, email or even offline interactions or Zoom calls, you know, video calls like this one. So what concretely do you think could be the next couple of steps to push back against these dynamics?
Well, I mean, I know you have a lot of people who are watching from Europe. I'm in Canada. It's really hard for us, right, to disentangle from these tech companies. It's not as hard as our friends in the United States, where they have just no hope, right, of getting out of that panopticon. But we do have the ability to try to keep our governments from doing things like what Yanis was just talking about in terms of giving Palantir an NHS contract, right? I mean, we have to push back so hard, because part of what's happening with the bubble, right, is that these tech companies are desperate. They're desperate for our data, but they also do want revenue because people aren't paying for their products in any way, shape, or form that covers the expenses. Governments are marks, right? They're very vulnerable. This is the new austerity, right? So they're coming to governments and they're saying, we can make you more efficient. But really they're trying to sell dead, dud products, right? But the point is that they don't really care about whether or not your experience trying to, talk to whatever your national healthcare service is or Social Security is. They don't care if you are talking to a bot rather than a person. You have the same experience that Giannis had trying to get a deep fake taken down. You can't find a person when you're, but now it's your, it's your Social Security check. It's your old age pension, right? But they're perfectly happy to throw people off because they aren't able to contact anyone. So I think the insidification of our public services is really the next phase. And we have to push back really strongly with this wave of contracts that's coming. It's not just Palantir. It's also OpenAI. It's Google. It's all of it.
Well, Makran, I think that we know what needs to be done. We need, for instance, a bill of digital rights so that your data is yours and no one can take it, either through AI hoovering up or in any other shape or form. And if they do, then they should be liable to be sued in the same way that they would if they stole your car. That's number one, a bill of digital rights. Number two, interoperability. We should legislate interoperability. So if, I want to get out of Twitter and I want to go to Blue Sky, then Twitter should have an obligation to transmit whatever post I upload on Blue Sky to everybody who has been following me so far on Twitter. Yeah, they do this in China as we speak, right? Thirdly, we should be working towards the, not nationalization, but the socialization of the means of communication. In a sense, to say to people like Google and Meta, if you want to have access to so much work that people put into creating your network effects, then you're going to have to deposit 20% of your shares in a social equity fund. And, the social equity fund should have voting rights. And then you take the 20% to 30%. We know what needs to be done in order to create civilization again, or the chance of civilization. But what we also know is that the moment Canada does that, or Europe does that, or Greece does that, or Indonesia does that, Donald Trump is going to come in and he will slap tariffs on you. He's going to abduct your political leaders using commandos, as he did in Venezuela. In other words, prepare for war. You see, the more power is concentrated in the hands of fewer and fewer people, the less likely it is through social democratic traditional bourgeois means to do that which is necessary in order to keep the prospect of civilization alive. In other words, the more power concentrates, the more radical we have to be.
Yeah, and I do think that that the moment the bubble bursts, I mean, it won't be one moment, it'll be a process, but things are going to change. It could happen next month, it could happen in 6 months. I think it will happen in the next year. We need to be ready with these demands, right? Because that is a moment of maximum leverage. And we do know what happened in 2008 when, we said we won't pay for your crisis, but we might not have been as ready as we should have been, all of us, with what we want instead, how we wanted to transform the financial sector in that moment. There's a lot of good policy work that has happened. Lots of people who used to work for these tech companies who got systematically purged and fired have gone. The AI Now Institute has a great sort of bill of rights that I would encourage people to look at, with really sensible demands like no AI use to maximize oil and gas extraction, no AI embedding in weaponry, no AI use for psychiatry, right? I mean, there's so many things that we are not where we are because we don't know. We are not where we are because we don't know how to fix it. It's about power, right? And so that moment when the bubble bursts, I really want to encourage people to focus in on it, right? I sometimes quote Milton Friedman about moments of crisis. It depends on what ideas are lying around. Let's have our ideas ready. Let's have our demands ready. That's when our leverage will be strongest, because that's the moment when people are going to lose their pensions because they're tied up in these companies. That's the moment when it's going to cause so much suffering and there's going to be so much public anger, and we're going to have a lot of people on our side in that moment, and we've got to use it. We cannot blow it. It's a huge moment.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Guys, I really appreciate your time. We're at the end of the stream. Good that we left it on a constructive note. Thank you, Naomi. Thank you, Yanis. Thank you to you guys out there for your comments and questions. If you would like to join DiEM25, hit dm25.org/join. If you would like to donate/donate. And we will see you 2 weeks from now. Take care and stay safe.
Thank you.